The reading is written in Exodus chapter 32, beginning at verse 1, to be found on page 90 in the Church Bible. Exodus chapter 32. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered round Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses, who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him." Aaron answered them, "Take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing, and bring them to me." So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they had handed him and made it into an idol, cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, Israel, brought you up out of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord." So the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterwards they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, because your people whom you brought up out of Egypt have become corrupt. They have been quick to turn away from what I commanded them and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and have said, 'These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt.' I have seen these people," the Lord said to Moses, "and they are stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone, so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation." But Moses sought the favor of the Lord his God. "Lord," he said, "why should your anger burn against your people whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, 'It was with evil intent that he brought them out, to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth'? Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self, 'I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever.' Then the Lord relented and did not bring to his people the disaster he had threatened." Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands. They were inscribed on both sides, front and back. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. When Joshua heard the noise of the people shouting, he said to Moses, "There is the sound of war in the camp." Moses replied, "It is not the sound of victory. It is not the sound of defeat. It is the sound of singing that I hear." When Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, his anger burned, and he threw the tablets out of his hand, breaking them to pieces at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf of the people had made and burned it in the fire. Then he ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it. He said to Aaron, "What did these people do to you that you led them into such great sin?" "Do not be angry, my lord," Aaron answered. "You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, 'Make us gods who will go before us.' As for this fellow Moses, who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him." So I told them, "Whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off." Then they gave me the gold, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. Moses saw that the people were running wild, and that Aaron had let them get out of control, and so become a laughingstock to their enemies. So he stood at the entrance of the camp and said, "Whoever is for the Lord, come to me." And all the Levites rallied to him. Then he said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man strap a sword to his side. Go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor. The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died. Then Moses said, "You have been set apart to the Lord today, for you were against your own sons and brothers, and he has blessed you this day." The next day Moses said to the people, "You have committed a great sin, but now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." So Moses went back to the Lord and said, "Oh, what a great sin these people have committed. They have made themselves gods of gold, but none, please, forgive their sin. But if not, then blot me out of the book you have written." The Lord replied to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. Now go, lead the people to the place I spoke of, and my angel will go before you. However, when the time comes for me to punish, I will punish them for their sin." And the Lord struck the people with a plague because of what they did with the calf Aaron had made. This is the word of the Lord.
If you have a church Bible in front of you, it would be useful if you kept it open as we go through this complex passage, which, as somebody said to me on the way in, is actually probably the darkest passage in the whole of the Old Testament. I hope it may help us if we just have a quick recap of the story so far in Exodus, just to put it all in important context. We're back in the 15th century BCE, and Egypt, where the Israelites have been exiled for about 430 years, that's where Exodus starts. The Jews had managed to more or less keep their own identity as people whose Lord was God himself, even though they'd been living surrounded all that time by polytheism. The Egyptians worshipped many different gods, amongst them real live cats, idols of bulls, idols of cows, and lots of other gods. But the glue that helped keep the Jews bound together and helped them retain their sense of nationhood was their shared inherited identity as descendants of Abraham, and also the promise that they held before themselves that God had given them, the promise that they would get their own fertile land in which they could live as a people. And the first 18 chapters of the story tell how the Israelites, together with Moses as their leader, were enabled to escape from captivity via the Red Sea, and then they went onwards through the wilderness as they searched for that land that God had promised them. And after 3 months and loads of adventures, which included walking through the Red Sea as it parted, it included the miraculous provision of manna for them to eat in the desert, it included drinking water coming out of a seemingly dry rock, and then they found themselves at in the Sinai Desert, and they camped at the foot of the mountain. And all of that then brings us to the second part of Exodus, in which we learn an awful lot about human nature, and much more importantly, about God's nature. We learn about his absolute zeal for holiness, and how he balances that against his love for mercy. And we also learn that he's willing to listen and to react to earnest prayer from faithful servants. In Exodus 19, God develops his promises to Abraham. Now, he says, if the people of Israel will obey him, if they'll stick to the terms of the covenant, they'll become a kingdom of priests. They'll be showing all the people around them what God is like, and they'll be showing them that by the way they lead their lives. And the people accepted the offer. Bring it on. And God's presence then came at the top of the mountain in a cloud. And God's presence summoned Moses up to the top of the mountain to meet with him as the people's representative. And God then proceeded to outline the basic terms of the covenant. And the basic terms were what we've known ever after as the Ten Commandments. And you'll remember that Tony spoke about them a week or two back. Let's just remind ourselves of the first couple of commandments, which start, and this shouldn't come as a surprise at all, bearing in mind where they've just come from, that the commandments start with a prohibition of polytheism, that worship of lots of gods that the people had seen around them. God said, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods but me." And then God had continued, "You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything, in heaven above or on earth below, beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down and you shall not worship them." And then he emphasizes that bit by saying, "I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments." And Moses wrote all that down and explained it to the people, who eagerly agreed to the terms of the covenant. And that then leads us into the next six chapters, which Mark so beautifully brought to life for us last week. And among other matters, that was when God gave instructions about how the tabernacle was to be built as a sort of hotspot for God's presence on earth. But it was all very complicated, and it took 40 days and 40 nights for God to give all those instructions to Moses. And during that time, Moses remained on the mountaintop with God, whilst back in the ground level base camp, things went from bad to worse. Just 6 weeks after issuing the Ten Commandments, God told Moses to go down onto the plain and warned him that he'd find people, those people he'd brought from the land of Egypt, they'd gone to pieces and were up to all their old tricks again. In no time at all, they'd turned away from God and had begged Aaron, Moses' brother, to take their earrings, to melt them down. And guess what? Aaron told Moses that he'd thrown it into the fire and out came a golden calf. Well, would you believe it? But the real question we need to ask at this point is, why was it that the people went to pieces? Why did they go off the rails? Why so soon after their freedom? And it seems to me that the answer is quite simple, and it's there right in verse 1. This fellow Moses, we don't know what's become of him. Only yesterday they were giving all the credit to Moses for bringing them out of slavery. But today he's yesterday's news, and they think it's time to move on. And the problem was, of course, that they weren't giving God the credit for all that had happened to them. They weren't giving God the credit for their redemption, but thought that it was down to Moses. Yesterday he was a superhero, but today he's an absent has-been. And the trouble was, of course, that they put their faith in the wrong place or in the wrong person. Perhaps if they'd given credit to God, then they wouldn't have been so anxious and wouldn't have felt lost in leadership. And I think this is the first really important lesson from this passage for us all. When God shows us his grace and mercy, then we need to look beyond the person he's using as the instrument of his grace. We need to look beyond, I don't know, the plumber or the AA patrolman or the surgeon, or maybe it's a relic of an old saint that you're praying to like an idiot. Whoever or whatever it is that maybe God has used as an instrument of his grace, you need to look beyond it and give God, who's the author of all goodness and mercy, the glory for what has happened. But from the people's point of view, Moses seemed to have abandoned them and gone off in a huddle with God, leaving them feeling high, dry and rudderless. And so their foolish response was to abandon both the prophet and abandon God and melt down their earrings and make themselves a sacred cow. Now, even if we set aside for 1 minute the fact that making idols is a direct disobedience to God, he has said we mustn't do it. Even if we look beyond that, we can see that there are real problems concerned with idol worship. When you start making anything an idol, it doesn't matter whether it's a physical object, doesn't matter whether it's a concept or an ism, doesn't matter whether it's greed for wealth or craving for status, the fact is that you start to manipulate and use both the idol and, more importantly, people for your own use. Just pick up your paper, look at the news, and you'll see what I mean. If you make money your God, for instance, then you're in danger of using others to feed your bank balance at their expense. And maybe you'll take it to the extreme and use other people as your slaves. Or if you make sex your God, you may end up sexualizing and dehumanizing others, maybe even including young girls and boys who you manipulate through pornography and fashion and pop culture and worse. And if your idol is status in this world, well, what's the betting that it's not long before you start stepping all over other people in your drive to accomplish your purposes? The simple truth is that idols have no morality. And the consequence of worshipping idols is that your worship is also devoid of morality. Idol worship is a sin, and idol worship always acts as a gateway to further sin. And time after time, history has proven that only when we worship the one true God will we treat others with the dignity and the respect that he intends and that they deserve. God had said, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Don't worship idols." But they ignored that and sacrificed to a model cow and then said, "Oh, look, these are the gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt. I, the Lord, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents unto the third and fourth generation of those who hate me." And Moses went down the mountain, and Moses was angry. Moses was very, very, very angry. But Moses wasn't half as angry as God was. "I've seen these people," the Lord said to Moses. "They're stiff-necked." That means they were like oxen that had got yokes on so that they could be steered and controlled. But they were so stubborn that they refused to yield to the yoke. "Now," said God, "let me alone so that my anger may burn against them and I may destroy them." and then I'll make you, Moses, into a great nation. But Moses bravely reasoned with God, even in his anger. In verse 11 he said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people? They're your people, they're not mine, they're your people, Lord, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand. And what follows sounds like a little bit of a squabble between a mum and dad when the kids have been naughty. Well, they're your children. No, they're not, they're yours. Moses, you've got to fix it. No, God, you've got to fix it. Come on, God, parents don't give up on their children. You can't give up on your children, Lord, even when they screw up. And then Moses appealed to God's honour and his reputation. And in verse 12 he says, why should the Egyptians say, it was with evil intent that he brought them out of my land, our land, to kill them in the mountains and to consume, exhume them from the face of the earth? Moses was arguing with God, what are the neighbours going to think of you? You know, God, you demonstrated your great love for your people and your great power to the Egyptians. And now you've put the Egyptians through all of that in order that they would free the captives. What are they going to think of you if you now destroy Israel out here in the wilderness? God, your reputation, you've already said it, is bound up with your people's fate. And his final argument with God was that Moses reminds God of his promises. In verse 13 he says, remember Abram, Isaac and Israel, your servants, how you swore to them by your own self, saying, I'll multiply your descendants like the stars of heaven, and all this land that I've promised I'll give to your descendants, and they'll inherit it forever. You see, if God had broken his promise, well, then he'd be showing himself to be no better than your average politician who promises the world and then delivers nothing. And after all those arguments from Moses, God relented from sending disaster. When Moses came down the mountain carrying that identical pair of stones, which had the Ten Commandments written on them, the physical record of the covenant between God and Israel, and he smashed them. He smashed them at the foot of the mountain to underline the truth that the covenant with God had been broken. And then he smashed the golden calf, and then he smashed those who'd done wrong. Those people among the Israelites who loved God were told to go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other and to kill their brothers and friends and neighbours who'd revolted against God. And 3,000 people were killed. And Moses went back to the Lord and said, oh, what a great sin these people have committed. They've made themselves gods of gold. But now, please forgive their sin. But if not, will you blot me out of the book you've written? Please forgive their sin. But if not, then blot me out of the book you've written. Imagine a bouncer standing outside the venue of where a wonderful party was taking place inside. And he got a clipboard in his hand with names so that he can check off those who have the right to enter and keep out those who are gatecrashers. By their actions, the Israelites had forfeited their right to be on the list of those who could go in. But Moses offered to be a substitute for them. If they can't be forgiven, said Moses, then remove my name from your book instead. And God listened to Moses and showed us all that he is faithful to his promises, even in the face of sin. And that very faithfulness of God is the cause for our Christian hope to this day. But, said God, who's ever sinned against me? He said, those I'll blot out of my book. Judgment will fall. And we can see judgment falling just two verses later in verse 35 as God sends the plague on the people. But that's only partial judgment. It's, if you like, a sign of what's to come. Full judgment was to be postponed for another 1500 years. Full judgment for the sin of the people came in a place called Calvary, where Jesus, who was God's own son, hung from a cross in darkness, taking the punishment for our sin and for the sin of the Israelites, for your sin and for my sin. Jesus stood in our place in the darkness, and his name was blotted out from the list of those acceptable in heaven. In a hint of what was to come, Moses had said, please forgive their sin, but if not, then blot me out of the book you've written. And Jesus had prayed from the cross, Father, forgive. And then his name was blotted out on our behalf. Our names, with all those who claim him as our Saviour, will never be removed from the list of those acceptable into heaven. Jesus earned the right to acknowledge us before his Father because he paid the price as he hung on the cross, and his name was blotted out instead of your name or my name. It's a bleak chapter, isn't it? But it's there, recorded so that we might have hope. We see a glimpse of Jesus through his faithful servant Moses. And we get a glimpse of the Father in his dealings with the sinful people at Sinai. God is holy, God is righteous, but God is also merciful. And just wonderfully, oh how wonderfully, even when we screw up right royally, God doesn't give up on us. He's going to take us with our failures, and he'll redeem us to holiness through Jesus. Nothing can separate us from the love of God, not even our sacred cows.